I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. I'm not sure I'd want to be a teenager today. Besides the perennial issues of fitting in, peer pressure, and pulling all-nighters for school, today's young people have to deal with social media bringing the worries of the world to their fingertips. So, is it any wonder that more of them are dealing with anxiety disorders? Wes Crenshaw says no. Today, the family psychologist evaluates what can cause teens to develop crippling preoccupations over issues ranging from body image to gender and even death. We'll discuss when parents should let kids struggle with normal adolescent angst and when it's time to seek help as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Are teens really more anxious today than in past years? If so, is that due to changing expectations, cultural dynamics, social media, or other factors? 25% of teens will at one point or another be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, and 6% will be considered severe. But when should parents let teens struggle through the normal ups and downs and angst of adolescence and start looking for help? Dr. Wes Crenshaw is back to talk about it. He's a Lawrence psychologist and author. He's board certified in couples and family psychology and targets much of his practice on working with teens and their parents. And Wes, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Pleasure to join you.
Let's start with understanding just what anxiety is and what it isn't, Wes. Run us through that.
Well, anxiety is a very natural human response. It's sort of that fight and flight response. It's the flight response. And what makes anxiety different from a normal fear is what I usually refer to as my bear metaphor. And I'm almost scared to use it because this morning in the news, it actually happened to somebody in Colorado, very close to someone I know's campsite. But if you're out in Colorado and there's a sign and it says black bears, you know, tie up your food, and you're in your tent and you hear a noise like the poor person this morning did in the news, yeah, it's probably a bear. That's a pretty good guess.
Yeah.
If you're in your home in Overland Park and you hear a noise outside and you jump up and say, oh my gosh, honey, it's that bear again. That's probably not a bear. Mm-hmm. It's probably the wind. And the anxiety part of it, it's the same response. It's the same emotional response, but one of them fits the situation, one of them doesn't. And anxiety is usually fear that doesn't fit the situation.
How is it different from stress?
Yeah, so stress is essentially, they're very highly connected. Stress is essentially a state-based response. Mm. So it's stressful to sleep in Colorado with a bear outside of your tent. and if it's in more serious terms, it's stressful to be, you know, in a difficult work environment or in a recession or in a troubling economic or political time. So that creates a stressful situation. The underlying predisposition is typically anxiety based. That's a trait. And some people are more prone to respond with anxiety, or as we've said before in the show, they simply care too much for their own good. And other people are less so. They are a little more carefree. And stress will affect the carefree people less severely than it will the more caring people.
Maybe we should point out there are also different kinds of anxiety, right?
There are, and it gets a little.
It comes in blue boxes and red boxes and everything else.
Yeah,
right?
And purple. We're going to get political whether we want to or not. Purple boxes. There are three overriding diagnoses that are most common in our profession. There's a thing called social anxiety disorder, and particularly for teens, that one can be very significant. I always look for that one first when kids come in, and this has to do with being fearful around other people. Now, this is not the same thing as being introverted, which is a preference, and it's not the same thing as being shy, which is simply, you know, sort of reserved. This is a really anxious reaction to being around others, worrying a lot about being self-conscious, being worried what people will say about you or think about you. And if you get around people, going way beyond the sort of bashful reaction to getting sweaty, shaking motor in coordination, all that kind of stuff. Then you have the really the most horrible one, and that's panic disorder. And the fundamental element of panic disorder is you have such a terrible reaction to something, and you may not recognize what it is. It isn't like there's the bear and you panic. It's sometimes you don't know why you're having this reaction. And the fundamental element is you think you're going to die. People will go to the emergency room and it will be believed they're having a cardiac incident, especially if they're more in the age range where that is common.
Right.
And then the third one is generalized anxiety. And, you know, at the risk of being too reductive, that is when your anxiety is so broad-based that you can't package it into a certain response set. It may occur in any situation. It might include some panic. It might not. It may just be this dread, this sense of angst, dread all the time when you wake up in the morning or late in the day. And there's a lot of other criteria that go along with that, but that's kind of the general overview.
This sounds like horrible stuff.
It's not a lot of fun.
Debilitating at times.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not predisposed to anxiety, because spending time with people who are is kind of anxiety producing, and I'm not making light of it at all. Mm-hmm. If you understand how impairing this is for young people and not so young people, and the worst of it is not, this sounds odd, but the worst of it is not when someone comes in and say they've lost a parent or they've lost a job or something. You kind of understand, and there's a problem solving process and grieving process that you go through that begins to kind of work that anxiety out. The hard ones are people who cannot identify why there is an anxiety problem. There's this underlying experience of it.
Yeah. If parents are listening, or even kids are listening, and they suffer from anxiety, I want to call in and talk to Wes about whatever it is they're struggling with. We'd like to have you. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You said a few minutes ago, just so I have this right, that social anxiety is the form of anxiety that kids are most likely to experience here?
Probably there are more kids that have a more generalized anxiety. However, social anxiety is very common amongst kids. And it just like all of these, they're on a continuum. So there are people who aren't quite diagnosable, but who have some level of social anxiety. And then there are people, we have trouble getting them to go to school. One of the major causes of school refusal is an expressed social anxiety by the child, so that they just have that much trouble being around other people. There are some other differential diagnoses that go along with that, but yeah, that is one that is not uncommon in teens.
They can't get out of bed and actually go to school.
Right. It's now, listeners should be aware that part of the trick of being a psychologist is to determine who is really impaired to the point where they cannot say go to school, and who is feigning those symptoms because school kind of sucks. Who amongst us really wants to go? And that is actually a very fine distinction. And part of getting kids in school refusal to go is not simply buying into the anxiety, which is going to be a theme in our show today, is buying into your anxiety is actually a big part of the problem.
I want to reiterate here, 25% of teens will at one point or another be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. 6% will be considered severe. 25% of teens, Wes, that makes you think that something is out there in the ether. You say you're seeing more anxiety lately than ever before. What's going on with that?
Well, I spend an anxiety-producing amount of time trying to figure this out because, as you know, my undergraduate degree is in sociology, and so I'm always interested in the social aspects of psychology. And I think there are the first thing I can guarantee is true. It is a multivariate equation. There is not just one thing. So if I had to jump on one, I would say as we talked about in November, the current political and social climate is very upsetting to kids. And very simply put, doesn't matter what side of the issue you're on. What matters is a lot
talking
of
talking about President Trump. Am I hearing you right?
That sounds like the man.
Okay.
I think, you know, I actually would say it's a little more than that. I think kids are not as upset with him as a person. They're upset with the movement that holds him up. This is what's frightening for them.
But this has been going on far earlier than President Trump taking office, though, hasn't it?
Think about it this way. And I want to be you and I could so easily go down this hole for the rest of the hour. So I want to be sure it's just it's a portion of this, but it is critical. So here, what you see is a trend culturally for kids to be opening up to gay and lesbian and transgender issues, the environment.
Kids are more open than ever.
We've done shows where we're like, kids, get up and vote. What's wrong with you? Well,
yeah.
They heard us. It's you and I, Steve, who got them to listen. And all over the nation, they got politically interested in the last few years. And so what they see as important is almost perfectly inverse to what is the political climate right now. Now, are there kids who are big Trump fans? Absolutely. But the trend you see in culture, the opening up trend, the idea of helping, you know, poor people and cleaning up the environment, these things are diametrically opposite. And this was a shocker to kids. It's almost like they got woke, as they say, and slapped in the face.
But what else is happening out there? Yeah, we've talked about cell phone use and
yes.
Facebook and Twitter and all the social media kids, you know, talking about each other in ways that maybe hasn't been done before. These are relatively new phenomenon too.
This all goes together. It all goes together because we have taught kids during this same period that cyberbullying and bullying people, you know, is a terrible thing. We've done a show on bullying. Schools did curricula on this. And what we see in media, and kids are both recipients of and participants in, is the angriest language personally spoken back and forth on social media anyone could imagine. Did people feel this way and talk this way before in history? Sure. People beat each other up on the playground and nobody did anything in my day. So, of course, there is a history of this, but it's now 24/7. Now, not just the bullying, but just being connected. I can text. I've already gotten 5 or 6 texts of people, let's say people I know professionally, texting me, oh, I hear you on the radio right now. I can text anyone probably who's under the age of 25 right now and instantly get them to respond to me because they are always on. So it's not just the negatives. Even the positives are stressful because you're always turned on to the world.
Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about teen anxiety with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Again, our number 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Cody from Kansas City, Missouri. Cody, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, guys. I've been diagnosed with a pretty bad anxiety disorder. I went into the hospital the other day, and my blood pressure was like 210 over 180, and my heart rate was over 140. And they immediately tried to give me benzos.
Right.
And I'm an addict. I'm a recovering addict, so I wouldn't take them. And I'm struggling right now with my anxiety disorder to not get on benzos. And I'm actually at the doctor right now, so I can't stay on. But I was just wondering if maybe you guys could talk about that and maybe help some people out about that, find some other options. Because of the epidemic going on in the country right now, benzos might not be the best option for some people.
Yeah, thanks, Cody. And explain what benzos are. Is that an opioid?
No.
Okay.
But he's making a lot of sense. So just to qualify, as a psychologist, I don't prescribe, but I have a doctoral level nurse practitioner in my office who does. And so we have an integrated system of medicine and therapy. These are things we deal with all the time. What he's referring to is one of the treatments, and you can look all this up on the National Institutes of Mental Health. I'm actually looking at that material right now. We're going to say this roughly the same thing. The treatment that is easiest medication-wise is to take benzodiazepines. Now, many people don't know what that is, but they know what Valium is. And Valium is a benzodiazepine. Mm-hmm. So is Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan. All of these are benzodiazepines. When I say it's the easiest, generally, that'll knock your anxiety down real quick.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that this creates a behavioral response to that medicine that when you feel the anxiety, you know, the next time you think, oh, I got to get that pill in me. Very, very, with Valium particularly, it's easier to get the camel through the eye of the needle than to get somebody off of Valium who's gotten into that level of a physical and behavioral response.
So it what do you do then if people need that kind of help and not getting them hooked?
Well, in all, I can only speak for me and my nurse practitioner. What we try to do is use those medicines as rescue meds. The caller is fearful as an addict. He is fearful he will start taking these and quickly become dependent on them. Dependency is not the same thing as addiction, but it is correlated to that. Addiction is when you're, you know, taking something you can't get off of and you crave it. Dependency is when it's helping you a lot.
Are there alternatives that don't involve medicine?
There are. There's a whole other class of medications that are typically the more first line uses, and they are the same ones as the antidepressants, like Lexapro, Effexor, Celexa, Prozac even a little bit is still used. And those medicines are not as habit-forming because you don't take them in response to the suffering that you feel.
Yeah.
But he's right to be interested in that, and we'll talk more about it, but I affirm his concern.
So anytime someone is prescribed one of these drugs, then you've got to begin to weigh the dependency addiction possibilities here.
Yeah, and much of what we're talking about is as true for adults as it is teens. It's particularly concerning when you're working with teens around medicine because medicine's a lifesaver. I don't want to go the wrong direction with that. But you also want to be careful because it has some other side effects that in the teen years can be troublesome.
Such as?
Well, so all of the SSRIs, like Zoloft would be the most common, and Lexapro. One of the things I've run into in working this beat for many years is that there's a high rate of reducing sexual desire and even ejaculated orgasmic dysfunction. And parents may be like, oh my gosh, yay, you know. No, that is not a yay. And I've had some young adults now who, when you're dealing with some sexual dysfunction issues, you ask them, how long has this been a problem? And, you know, they've been on one of those medicines since they were 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And so there may have been a suppression of natural sexual urge or sexual response that isn't really very helpful when you're trying to figure this out in adolescence. Does that mean you shouldn't use them? No, it doesn't. It means that's one of the factors you have to think that people often don't think about with teens.
Let's go back to some calls here. Folks have been waiting for a little bit. Julie from Overland Park. Julie, good morning.
Good morning. I am an educator and a youth advocate. I am thrilled this conversation is taking place.
Good.
As someone who works with youth and as someone who had a severe panic disorder that I hospitalized myself during the 80s against both families' wishes, who wanted me to pull myself up by my bootstraps at a time when it was called hypochondria, at a time when I was prescribed every medication, including Valium and Librium, and had someone just been available that knew it and reassured me that I wasn't crazy, that this was, that there was treatment. I found meditation and exercise to be helpful with the right medication, but just knowing I wasn't crazy. And I find that with kids too. It's such a release just to have the conversation with somebody they trust.
That's interesting, this notion that a lot of kids don't even know that what they're dealing with is unusual.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Or it's not unusual is my point. Yeah.
I think that's right on the money. The one thing I will say for kids is that their research skills nowadays are amazing.
Absolutely.
Doctors hate for people to self-diagnose, but I had a client one time who was totally sure that she had Crohn's disease. And it's very unusual in this age group. And I said, oh, you know, you're kind of anxious. It's probably irritable bowel. And she says, no, I've got all the symptoms. And I thought, oh my goodness. So we sent her to the gastro. She absolutely had Crohn's disease and was very helpful that she had self-diagnosed. So kids are able to research and learn a lot about mental health issues now. And I think that has helped destigmatize. And it also helps them give us data. When they come in, a lot of kids come in and say, you know, I think I'm really depressed. And I'm like, okay, prove that to me. And they give me the criteria. They can just interface so well. Now, could there be a downside to that? Kids, you know, become overly symptom focused. Absolutely. We see it all the time. But in general, it's nice to see more kids able to consume and talk about that information instead of suffering like our caller is talking about in this sort of lonely space.
Well, and Julie might respond to this, but any notion that anything related to mental illness someone was dealing with when I was a kid, of course, was never talked about. And Julie, it sounds like you're saying, and Wes is saying, that this is coming out in the open much more so than it used to, which has to be a beneficial thing.
It is coming out, but not much more than it used to. We still need to advocate on the part on behalf of mental illness and treatment and options and those kinds of conversations. And we also need to especially advocate for kids because they are getting their information from all kinds of sources. When we do not have these conversations with young people, they will go to the next best thing, which is their friends.
Yeah.
And get advice about mental illness from their friends. And this conversation opens up options.
Well, we are glad to be having it.
Julie, thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Let me go to one more call before a break here. Ann from Kansas City, Kansas. Ann, you're on Up to Date with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Good morning.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm going to echo Julie. There are parents and people who love kids all across the area right now who are applauding this conversation. So thank you for that. But unfortunately, not everyone who needs to hear this is hearing it. And even if they hear it, they don't believe it. And we're really quick to dismiss our children as bad kids or that there's a problem with them or they're making it up. So my question or what I'd like to know is the suggestion of how I most effectively introduce this topic and influence others who are around my child that are touching him and interacting with him that could very much hurt him if they're not believing him. So how can I help them understand this is real and this is true to be an advocate for these children?
Yeah, great question, Ann.
So I think if you're referring to professional people like teachers and folks like that and you're wanting to advocate for your child, I think there no one can do a better job of that than the parent. And being able to go in and really cite examples of how, for example, in school, 504s or IEPs are written and developed for kids and their unique concerns. So if you have an anxious kid, how do you keep them going to school? How do you recognize the problems they're having and also, you know, hold them accountable? That's why we try to get into the schools and put together, you know, there's about three levels, a student improvement plan, what's called a 504, and then the thing people are familiar with is an IEP. It's hard to get those nowadays because schools are overtaxed and underfunded. There's a big surprise.
Yeah.
And so it's harder for them to make some of those flexible responses. But I think you have to go in and cite the – there's an extensive literature on how to intervene. And there's a great book I have cited before. It's called From Emotion to Advocacy. Maybe the easiest way to find it is to go to my website, and on the online books, we have a list of books, and one of them is that book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, in the interest of full disclosure, I think I make 15 cents if you go through there. So you don't even need to go through there, but that's the quickest way to find it. It's called From Emotion to Advocacy. It's huge, and it really is – its whole purpose is to get you into a – school or other environment and advocate for a special needs child, both legally and, you know, morally, if you will, just from an ethical standpoint. And they do a marvelous job of it. It's a great tool.
Well, I really don't think that you can wrap this whole conversation up in your 30-second elevator speech, but every day people just very unknowingly and unpurposely say things that are hurtful. I mean, for example, the other day I was in a meeting with my son. It was kind of school and personal related with a bunch of other peer children, and a parent just said something very untactful about, oh, well, that's all those kids who are just on all those medicines and such.
Yeah.
So my son has actually decided not to take medicine because he is approaching it and dealing with it with some other ways like exercise and health and diet, which I'm so appreciative of. But still, it really stung. And I would just like to have known what I could have and should have said to influence that parent and be an advocate for my child there. And I was more kind of stunned and didn't necessarily know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'd really like to get your suggestion.
And those moments come out of nowhere, and you always wish you had them back and could say what you need to say. Wes, any thoughts on what she might have said?
Yeah. Well, the people get into a mindset about things. There have been a bunch of books written about ADHD, and, you know, I've written one of those, and I think it's pretty well reasoned. And some of the things that books that are written, my favorite title is ADHD Does Not Exist. It's an awful book. And, you know, this people are drug companies. Me and the drug companies are coming after your kid, forcing you to take medicine. This isn't happening. And when you say that, people think they're helping people by saying this. It shames people who are benefiting extraordinarily from medicines for ADD or anxiety or depression. It shames them, and it makes them sort of feel there's a conspiracy against them, and that is not helpful. Everybody has to make this decision, including teenagers. We won't provide medication to a teenager who refuses it.
Yeah.
And teenagers are part of our team, and they need to be part of the treatment team, and to feel like they have a voice in that process. And that is why we have a very high rate of compliance for both psychotherapy and medication management, is because we see kids as a part of that team and not as, you know, objects or people of shame. And right. I think you're correct. It's just very hard in this climate today of polarization to get people to hear that message sometimes.
Ann, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation about teens and anxiety with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. We're going to talk more about treatment options. We're going to get phone calls from Renee and Tony, so if you would, please hang on. Our phone number here, as we talk about this, if you have experiences or questions you want to share, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888. Option 2 is to tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to UpToDate on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we learned about the reasons behind KC's apartment boom and how state Democrats plan to recover in Missouri. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate or on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll speak with the dean of MU School of Journalism. Also, Kansas City jazz saxophonist legend Bobby Watson shares some stories behind his latest album. Bobby Watson on the show tomorrow. This hour, we're talking with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about teens and anxiety. Turns out that 25% of teens will at one point or another be diagnosed with some type of anxiety disorder. What's going on in the country? We're eager to hear your thoughts. 816-235-2888. Let's talk just for a minute, Wes, about treatment options here. And one option before medication is therapy. What do you recommend along those lines? What are you seeing out there when it comes to therapy?
Yeah, there's kind of two schools of thought about when to enter the therapy and medication realm. We tend to recommend people seek a mental health evaluation, and often, depending on the kid or adult, a physical exam also, because there are some physical conditions that can masquerade as psychiatric conditions, and you don't want that. Mm-hmm. Don't want to be mistreating anybody. So then one can either proceed with psychotherapy for, you know, 7 to 8 sessions, used to be the recommendation, or do a dual therapy, because most of the research indicates that, you know, psychotherapy and medication go together like the horse and carriage, and that people who are in each of those groups, the people who will benefit the most are in the combined treatment mode.
Doing both.
Yeah, that's what we see. And the therapy for this has long been two forms. One is cognitive behavioral therapy, and the other is exposure therapy, and they kind of go together.
Explain those to us. Yeah.
Okay. Exposure therapy is best when there's something you can identify that is upsetting. You know, the old classic is snake phobia, but the one we most frequently see is social anxiety. And what you do is you have the young person go into situations that are upsetting to them. Slowly go. Maybe they go stand in a room with people that aren't upsetting to them, family maybe, or maybe they're only upset in the presence of people they do know. So you go to the mall, you figure out what's the least frightening thing to do. And you can actually do this. They have virtual reality versions of this now, but you can actually go out and physically do this with a person and help them do calming, which is the cognitive behavioral part of it, calming sensations, you know, working through it. And then the theory being that once they are not, once they've done this a few times, that's old hat. And
it's repeated exposure. You get used to it after a while.
Systematic desensitization is the other term.
You don't like riding in an elevator, you go ride an elevator a bunch of times to get used to it. It's that idea.
Dating anxiety. Albert Ellis, famous cognitive therapist, used to have people do all these just ridiculous things in New York City. Get on the subway, and you had to stand up at every stop and yell out, 42nd Street! And, you know, people are like, oh, my gosh. And
what does that have to do with dating anxiety?
Well, because it gets – because if you can do that, you can ask out a girl. Then he would send them –
That's the thinking. Okay.
Then he would send them to Central Park and make them ask out 100 persons of their desired gender and come back and report it. Eventually, the people on the subway were like, oh, my gosh, there's another guy from Ellis's clinic.
They knew what was going on.
But that was early work in Ellis was merciless. A lot of his descendants that are his followers have done these drills, and you hear all these stories about it.
What's the other one?
The other that is derived actually from that same history is called ACT, and it's spelled like, you know, the ACT, but you call it ACT. And I've been studying it a lot. I went to their 4-day seminar last year. I'm going to 2 more days, and they have long 12-hour days. And this is a theory that goes a little out the other direction, and it argues the more we teach people to suppress anxiety, the worse it gets. So if I tell you, Steve, for the next rest of the show, I don't want you to think about Trump in a pink elephant outfit. Don't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to think about Trump in a pink elephant outfit. That's the worry about straight cognitive behavioral techniques, is that you're just causing people to then focus on anxiety. The ACT model uses a huge amount of meditation, which a caller mentioned earlier, and the research is clear that meditative exercise is helpful in these situations.
That's interesting.
And pairs that with the idea that rather than fight the anxiety, you learn to accept it and not live through it, live out of it.
That's interesting.
And you choose what you want to, how you want to behave based
on your
values.
Is there one school of thought that you tend to put your chips in?
I'm putting my chips in ACT right now because I think...
ACT meaning the exposure?
Well, ACT being this... meditation, cognitive, and exposure plays a part in ACT also. The idea that you're not going to fight it, you're not going to fight this feeling anymore, if you want to quote REO Speedwagon. Mm-hmm. You're going to accept it non-judgmentally, and they talk about stepping back and watching it sort of meditatively pass by you as it's objectifying it. Now, that sounds all groovy. When you get into doing it really practically, people like it, they get it, and it's about choice. It's about choosing the direction you want to go and accepting yourself.
Teens and anxiety is our topic. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here. Renee from Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for holding on, Renee.
Hello. I was calling in as a mother of 3 kids. My youngest is only 10, but at least ever since she's 3 or 4, I have seen the signs of maybe more of a general anxiety. It definitely permeates throughout her life in school. She dreads new classes. She dreads any kind of competitions or going up to the board and knows when those days are coming. She dreads sports. Her sister is 16 months older than her, and so she's an extrovert. And we as parents have really had to learn, much to my daughter's expense, that they're very different people.
Yes.
And not, you know, that with her anxiety, she does not want to do that. When she comes home from school, she is exhausted from simply interacting with everyone. And we really had to figure that out. She taught us mainly through just kind of talking with us that we didn't understand her. And finally we listened, and I'm starting thankfully to get it. One of the big reasons I called in was just something that made a world of difference for us was a weighted blanket at night. She would tell me that she was tired throughout the day because she didn't sleep all night because she stayed up thinking about things. And so I explored options, saw that it was a cheap, relatively easy thing to try, got one, and ever since then, I mean, the difference is night and day. So I just thought I'd throw that out there for anybody else.
And Renee, a weighted blanket, is it just what it sounds like?
Yes, somebody made it for me. I went and picked out the material, and they put little beads inside. It's a lot of sewing involved, little compartments all together. They go by the child's weight and the size of the bed, and she loves it. The material is soft and fuzzy, and it's just kind of, it's a little bit of weight and just enough that, when we go anywhere on vacation, she wants to take it with her so she can get a good time.
Because it makes her feel more secure that there's this comforting blanket wrapped around her.
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Because whatever it's it's just enough to help her not stay up and worry all night.
And I might add that not knowing your kiddo, obviously I cannot say, but what you're describing is the thing we do frequently with people on the autism spectrum. They often like those weighted things. You can actually buy jackets that are not hot but are kind of heavy, and that is very comforting. If you've ever seen the film Temple Grandin,
She's been here a couple times.
Yes, she's amazing, and the squeeze machine. So that's an interesting point.
Right. Renee, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Let's go to Tony from Kansas City, Kansas. Tony, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. I had, I guess, hopefully it's not too broad of a question. I'm 28 years old. I am a black and Mexican person. My dad's Mexican and white mixed. And I was thinking about the racial anxiety I had in school. Mm. I went to a Sumner Academy, which I guess I could say, thankfully for me, was mostly black. But there was still I still had problems with some white students and just being made fun of for who I was. And so I guess my first kind of pointed question is, is there anything that can be personally done about racialized anxiety, especially in teens and then moving on to adulthood when we know it's a bigger societal issue?
Right.
So kind of how do you avoid the problem per se? And
let me have him respond to that first, Tony, then we'll get to any other questions here. Racialized based anxiety, Wes.
I think that definitely is present, and I think it comes in so many different forms. And the reality is whoever is on the out group, whether it's historically we've seen this problem with LGBTQ kids, those are the people who are going to get identified. And from a racial standpoint, black folks have been on the out for a long time. And the problem is I don't know where we're headed with that. I am very interested in it. It seems that there's more disharmony right now. And teens thought we were headed as a culture down a more inclusive route. There certainly almost every white teenager I know is a big supporter of Black Lives Matter. And again, they see this as headed the wrong direction now. So that is a fantastic question. It defies an answer right now, but I think we've got to continue to develop communities that have like interests and what we call superordinate goals, rather than splitting people into factions. And that just doesn't sound like where we're headed as a culture. So there's going to be more anxiety around that, more anxiety on the part of the out group, and I think more anxiety on part of those who identify with or sympathize with out groups. It's a strange time for that.
Yeah, Tony?
Yeah. That's actually a lot how I was feeling. I kept thinking, I was like, is there a good answer that's direct? You can't really just give Xanax for worrying about someone shooting you, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't really fix it, but it makes me feel a little less anxious myself, knowing that it's not such a crazy thought to be like, I guess we're all going to be working together. Maybe that will relieve the anxiety.
I want that to be true because I think there's a strength emotionally in that idea, not just politically, and that people will feel less anxious if they feel they are connected and moving in a good direction. But getting us there, I don't know. You and I will have to come up with a solution for that, and then we'll be super famous.
That would be great.
Yeah,
okay. That would be wonderful.
Tony, thanks for the good call, and good luck to you, okay?
Thank you so much.
Wes, we just have a few minutes left. I wanted to get to this notion of how do teens feel about being told they need therapy, and how do you go about this idea of getting them connected to a therapist that they can work with?
Yep, it's a great question. So teens come in two flavors when it comes to therapy. There are the leaders and the followers, or in some cases, the demanders and the draggies. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of depends on how extreme. Very frequently at this point do we have kids who are asking to go to therapy. It is very common. I bet half the people on my caseload raised the issue with a parent. Some parents responded quickly and others did not. As one of the callers mentioned earlier, people sometimes don't want to deal with this. For kids who are then there are the draggies or the followers. And generally what will work is if the parent brings the kid in, sits with them in the first session, because we prefer that anyhow. We always want to have everybody's input in the first few sessions, and then we stay connected thereafter. And then if the therapist is good at connecting with the kid, that's going to appear very quickly. I have people I've seen for, you know, years who would have rather slashed the tires on my car in the parking lot than come in to see me and been done with me. And they have been wonderful clients because they realize that it isn't how they imagine it to be. So I think the connection is critically important.
Let me go to Bill from Leawood. Bill, you're on Up to Date. Bill, I've got about 30 seconds here.
Okay. My son was diagnosed initially with ADHD, and I was going through a divorce. I did not want him to be on ADHD medicine, which we believe led him to develop anxiety because, as you know, a lot of ADHD medicine is synthetic amphetamines. And he was a normal kid. He was basically a B-plus student, and my ex wanted him to make A's, and I was okay with him not making A's. It was okay for him to make B-plus.
Got to go quickly, Bill.
So the question for you is that there are methods to treat anxiety other than medication and talk therapy, which is one of them is transcranial magnetic stimulation.
That is true.
Available now in Kansas City. It's available in Kansas City. I brought three of the machines here to my son's psychiatrist. They've been using it and having a lot of success with it.
I'm going to have to cut you off. What is that, Wes? Just quickly here.
In our office, we call that the magnetic hat. And not to be disparaging, they were doing MRIs on bipolar people about 10 or 15 years ago and began to realize that they were getting better. That wasn't the goal. It was to study their brains. And so they began to develop that and now have this it looks like ECT, but it's not. You basically, they send magnetic waves through your brain. Hmm. Now, the one catch I want to add is that's research on that is only for bipolar people. They're developing it, but the rest of it for teens and for other disorders is still something that is approved but not completely proven. But we've sent people for it.
Dr. West, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here, as always.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw, Lawrence-Bay psychologist and author. On tomorrow's show, the dean of the Mizzou School of Journalism will discuss the future of that profession. Then the great Bobby Watson, who composed the music you're listening to right now, will be with us to talk about his new recording. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.